happen. So my name is Evan Cavanaugh, and as I said before, I'm sitting in today for my esteemed mentors, Donald and Sylvia. I happen to be on staff here at Spirit Rock, and don't sit in this chair very often, and just love to do it when I do. Really, I feel very lucky to work here at Spirit Rock. So, as I prepared my remarks and our time together today, I found out more than I knew, perhaps, that I'm really pretty stuck on myself. If any of you know me, that may be no surprise. I don't know. It might be a bit of a surprise. But there are a couple of examples of the ways I found that I'm stuck on myself. I got LASIK surgery a little more than a month ago, and it's an amazing experience. With the help of a prescribed Valium, I'm laying there on the table, and the surgeon is coming down with tweezers going, all right, I'm going to lift your cornea now, and he does. And then they shoot little lasers at the lens on your eyeball to reshape the lens of your eye, and then they use a little paintbrush to paint the cornea back down on it, and just see this paintbrush going over your eye, you know. With the help of a prescribed Valium, I was just laying there going, this is amazing. and it was. It was just astounding. So the morning after the surgery, I have the common experience that I've had other friends report to me, that they wake up and they look around and they turn, and they can actually see what time it is on the alarm clock. Mm-hmm. It was great. Now, mind you, I have one of those clocks that has those really big letters, because usually I have to squint. But there, plain as day, there were the letters. It was really great. Now, not just to be contented with that miracle, I got up, and as I usually do, I went into the bathroom and started whatever preparations I was making for the day, and I looked at myself in the mirror. Now, I was seeing myself in the mirror unaided by any lenses for the first time in a very long time. I've worn glasses regularly since high school. And my first thought, truth to tell, was, oh my goodness, without glasses hiding my face, I need to go get some eye cream. And I did. So, my first thought, seeing myself for the first time in many years, clearly, and my first thought was about myself and my appearance and self-improvement. And as time went on, I was actually a little surprised by this. I hate to say, I like to think of myself as having loftier thoughts, but no. So, my other example about being obsessed with myself actually surrounds the composition of my remarks and our time together today. The last time I gave a talk like this, it was on self and gay identity. Very interesting weaving of things, and identity comes in and how society views myself as a gay man. And I tried really hard to make this talk about something other than self or identity. And everything I wrote just kept coming back to self. So let's hope that this wasn't simply obsession with myself, but was the struggling of some wisdom to be free. And I think we'll all discover that together as we go off. We're going to, as I warned some of you before, we're going to do some interactive things today. So those of you who hate it can dread it. You're welcome to that. I'd actually like to make my first exercise assignment right now. And it's kind of like you're going to have homework for a little later when we're going to do some interactive stuff around it. And as I'm talking now and as I continue, I'd actually like you to identify a time when you think I'm wrong about something. And when you do that, I'd like you to pause for a moment. I guarantee you I won't say anything so brilliant that you'll miss it in the little pause. I'd like you to pause for a moment and go inside and see what it feels like to be right and to have me be wrong. I'd like you to examine that and experience it. And then kind of when you're done doing that, just kind of come back with your attention to the group Now, after that first instance of discovering a time when I'm wrong and you're right, I'd like you then to give up that practice entirely and not spend the rest of the talk looking for instances when you are right or I am wrong. Not as if all my words will be manna from heaven as you do that, but just surrender that and just kind of go in more to see if you can be in an open receptive state rather than a judgmental state. And just see how that goes, really as an experiment. So that's the homework assignment, and we'll check in about that later. Okay. Now, as a community here in the Insight Meditation world in Northern California, I'm aware that we spend a good deal of time trying to get rid of our sense of self, of our identity. We actually imagine that what we're supposed to do is, as good practitioners, or for those of you who think of yourself as Buddhists, to let go of self, and that's the secret that we're supposed to be doing here. Kind of as if our motto was, I am self, therefore I am bad. So that somehow we place great value in not having a strong sense of self. I actually think this tendency, this view, doesn't have as much to do with meditation practice or Buddhism, but it has a lot to do with the roots of American culture. And it goes even further back to the probably Christian, although I'm no history expert, probably Christian idea of original sin, where we're bad in the first place and we need to be made good somehow. And that getting rid of self, or enlightenment, as some of us hold that as, ultimately, is kind of like the Buddhist version of being saved. So, everything will be great once I, I'll finally be pure once I'm rid of self. Be that as it may, here we are, human, and this ego, this self we have, actually serves a pretty good purpose. We use it to protect ourselves from people inappropriately intruding on us. We use it to set boundaries. And we use it to kind of walk through this world that we live in. So, what are we going to do? I got to tell you, I'm in this place where I bought that eye cream and it's expensive, so I don't just want to toss it all away. Still with the self that's real day to day. Now, what the Buddha actually taught about self. As I said, there's a lot of ideas that people think the Buddha taught that there is no self. Well, the Buddha never actually said there is no self. In fact, he distinctly avoided doing that. There's a particular sutta where he distinctly avoids doing that. What he repeatedly taught was that there was no thing to be pointed at that is self. So all phenomena is not self. That's not self, that's not self, that's not self. But he didn't go and say that there is no self. In fact, he said that that would pretty much confuse us. It might have even been one of those things he called an imponderable, that, we just essentially don't have the capacity to understand. So overall, he pretty much says, I'm not going there. My teachings are that all phenomena are not self, and I won't tell you if there is or is not ultimately a self, because you would just be confused by that. So the good news is the Buddha didn't spend a lot of time worrying about what is an ultimate truth. And he just, the imponderable served that. It's like, I don't have to talk about ultimate truths. You just listen to what I have to say, experience for yourself, and I will do my best to help you be happy, to live a life that is useful and one that leads to contentment. So neither this nor that is self. I'm here today having bought the eye cream, so I've clearly got the self thing going on. I'd be willing to wager that a few of you might have some eye cream somewhere. So, our day-to-day reality is that we've got this self. And yet we think this self is in the way of us being happy. And indeed, that's what the Buddha taught us, that this is not self, this is not self, this is not self. It's kind of this central mistake we make that leads to so much unhappiness. So our sense of self is in the way. And there's a great saying that I've heard, that if it's in the way, it is the way. So today we're going to plow right through the middle of self. We're going to glorify it, we're going to, you know, give it a good go, and investigate it a bit as a way, as the way, actually. So getting to know ourselves is our job. How we see, how we realize our perception of self, or especially importantly, today we're going to concentrate a little on how do we reinforce our sense of self. The Buddha taught that we were wrong about having the self that we imagine we have, as I've said. Maintaining that sense of self takes a lot of energy. What the Buddha actually taught was that there's this very basic thing, what's the theory of dependent origination. The first thing in it is that we misperceive the way things are by perceiving that we have a self. And so at the very beginning of every moment is this misperception. And maintaining the sense of self against the realities of the universe takes a lot of energy. So just for an example, you've got my eye cream, right? I go out and buy that eye cream because I'm using it to maintain the sense of a self that needs to be better looking. The big circles under the eyes need to go away. All of us in this room have our version of eye cream, whether it's in a jar or it's clothing or it's something. And if we multiply that times all the different ways that we manifest self, times all the people in the world, oh my goodness, think about the money and energy and stuff we spend in this global incarnation worrying about self. It's really quite astounding, probably more than we spend on war. Not that war is not associated with this, believe me. And I'm aware that, with the eye cream money, eye cream isn't cheap. With the eye cream money, I could have gone on vacation. I could have maybe fed a hungry child. There are lots of different things I could have done with that. But here I am self-recriminating and mistaking that I have a self, or building up myself, or tearing down myself. Are actually all the same mistake. The Buddha taught that it's the comparison of oneself to another that is the problem, whether you're making yourself better than or worse than some other person. It's the endeavor of comparing that actually causes suffering. So, back to that first assignment. How many of you so far have found a time when I was wrong? It's okay. It's all right. I gave this talk the other day, and every hand in the room went up, so it was all right. How many of you are really did but aren't saying? Okay, I'm going to persist in the belief that there are more rights and wrongs out there than are revealed. And I know that for the sake of this exercise, one need not pick your experience today. I'm sure any of us can call up any time in our lives when we know we were right and someone else was wrong. From personal experience, I'm sure of that. So I'd like you to pair up. Let's actually do that. Go ahead and just find one other person to be with, and if need be, a couple other people, but preferably one other person. Just turn to your neighbor. Okay, so does someone need a partner? Okay, yes, come on down here. Tony, okay, you're set over there. Okay, you can be three, and you'll have to manage the time yourself. So your assignment in this is that I'd like you to talk about with your partner how you felt when you found something that you were right about. I want you to really investigate and describe the feeling tone in your body or your thoughts about what happened when you were right. Maybe you felt intelligent or self-righteous. You might have even felt ashamed. All sorts of things could happen. Ah, thank you so much, Kevin. So what happened when you were right or self-righteous? And then after that...
Is it too loud?
Yes, it's too loud. Yeah. Wouldn't want to have that happen. So after you found...
Better?
How's that? Great. So then I'd like you to talk with your partner about how it was being assigned to let go of the judging practice. And if you reached a point where you found out I was wrong about something, how was the time afterwards, and were you actually able to let go of that? So each one of you will have 3 minutes to talk to the other about it. I will ring the bell in 3 minutes, and then we will swap. You all will have to divide. You'll have 2 minutes each, and you'll have to figure that out, okay? Go.
When we were sharing, and I was talking about my experience being right, I realized as I was saying it how much energy there was in my feeling that I was right and this other person was wrong, and how that energy could easily turn into an aggressive feeling. And I thought, whoa, this is pretty powerful, that process of judgment.
Anyone else? Please.
We both talked about that feeling of that energetic feeling, and our experience both was that it felt really good.
Uh-huh. There's a certain revving up there, isn't there? Uh-huh. Yeah, totally. Did anyone have an experience of actually letting go of that sense of trying to find me being wrong? Yes? No, I had someone talk to me about it the other day who said that there was a certain freedom. They were actually able to notice some period of time where they weren't in judging mind, and that it was a big weight off her shoulders, is what she said. Elizabeth?
Exactly the same.
Yeah.
I was constantly thinking. I mean, I was more attentive, I think, more to your talk. But is he right? Is he wrong? Is he right? I'm just basically trying to judge what you're saying. And then at one point I said, you know what, I think he's saying some good stuff here, and I'm going to let go of that. I don't want to get, judge anymore, because it actually felt more comfortable not to judge you.
And, I don't know about you, but when I do this, I usually do this internally. I mean, oh my goodness, the storm that erupted when I was asked to give fewer instructions. The internal storm that erupted. You know, I was like looking at the clock, trying to do the math about dividing how often I'd spoken, and just, was I right? Was I wrong? Was I right? Was I wrong? And that was, oh man, it was a great diversion from my breath for quite a while. Yes, please. And how was that?
It was not good.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Now, so, I had just been listening. But I was, starting out, well, was he right or was he wrong? I got into all that.
So all that effort took you away from actually being present in the moment.
Right.
Funny thing. All right, we're done. That's the talk for today. Definitely.
We also came up with a question.
I didn't find anything wrong with your talk, but I remembered an instance of my husband where I was positive I was right and he was wrong.
Sure.
And it got to the point where I let go and I said, the world will teach him that he's wrong. Mm. I don't need to do it. And I kind of backed down and, But then I thought that was a sign of weakness maybe on my part, so that when is it okay to stand up for yourself when you think you're right?
I'm actually going to sidestep that. And what I really notice is that even when you weren't in the place of, am I right? Is he right? Then it's like, okay, I'll forgive. I'll let go. Then it's like, oh, no. So there's still the storm and the tumult around the rightness or the wrongness. It continues in all these different guises, and yet it continues. So there clearly there are times in our lives when we need to stand up and protect ourselves or to say what's appropriate. And even in those times, I think I'm just inviting us today to be mindful about it. I'm not sure there is a right answer, but I'm just suggesting that since this so often stands in the way of our being present and of our being happy, that we really go right through it, that we see it, that we experience it, have it be okay to experience it. Because this sense of I or me that we prop up with this energy, with this little, this little trip we can go on about being right. I mean, I used to be an alcoholic, and I am an alcoholic. I used to drink a lot, and this is better than that, I got to tell you. As we use that energy or use the tumult to prop up our sense of self, our sense of rightness, it's we do it a lot. And again, I really invite you over the next several days to investigate how your experience is with that, how much energy it does or doesn't take in your daily lives. When you do that, kind of really turning your attention to it, really have kind of a dual thing going on where you're out here in the world, but you're also paying attention to what's going on in your body and in your mind. What is the flavor of what's going on? What does the mind state feel like? And just get acquainted with that and spend some of your attention on it. As we've said, when we're reacting with the sense of I, me, right, me, out front, it really takes us away from the present moment in a very real way. And I actually believe, I'm not a psychologist, but I actually believe that that is happening because of an old hurt of one sort or another. We've put another layer of armor that is our ego to protect something. So what I really encourage you to do is when this sense of I, me, right comes up, when you investigate that feeling tone, spend some time asking yourself if this feeling tone takes you anywhere, if it's familiar. My guess is that a lot of us, when we really follow these feeling tones, end up in some experience that happened when we were young. That certainly has been true for me. As I have followed this feeling tone, is that feeling familiar? And all of a sudden, a memory just arises. And generally, it's a memory of something that happened that was difficult and that I never dealt with. And so here I am today, playing it out on you, in my sense of rightness, in my sense of meanness, being other than you. And I'm pretty clear that actually doing that work of just allowing those things to come up and to feel them as we haven't felt them will make today's interaction less, will make today's self-obsession reduce, and will experience more freedom. Now, if you take this as a practice that resonates with you and you come up against things which are quite difficult, many of us have had quite difficult things in our lives, you don't have to go there all at once, and you don't have to go there alone. So I would encourage you to take it in bits if it's a big thing that comes back for you, or to talk with a trusted advisor about it. Could be a therapist, could be a Dharma teacher, could be a good friend that you trust. But I would encourage you not to let the pain stop you from investigating, because the little bits of pain that are all this obsession with self today add up to a lot more than whatever it was that happened quite a while ago. One of the best Dharma books that I have run across recently was given to me by Spirit Rock teacher Julie Wester, written by a non-Buddhist, and it's called Don't Sweat the Small Stuff at Work. I don't know if she thought I was sweating the small stuff a lot, and that's why she gave it to me, but in any case, the author Richard Carlson writes about letting go of the ego, which is exactly what we're talking about today. And he has some interesting, some nice things to say. In addition to the obvious drawbacks, The ego is an enormous source of stress. Think about how much energy and attentiveness it takes to prove yourself, show off, and defend your actions. In case you hadn't noticed, most of the time when teachers take little Dharma quotes, it's because the book is agreeing with what the teacher was saying. The self thing, it's just, I'm having a little rush here, it's great. Think about how draining it is to constantly be keeping score of how you're doing and to be overly concerned with what others think about you. I get tired just thinking about it. Easing off your ego is accomplished by intention. The first step is to have the desire to shrink your ego down to size and to see how destructive and stressful it can be. The rest is easy. All it takes is humility.
Oh, no problem.
All it takes is humility and patience. Begin paying attention to your thoughts and behavior. When you notice yourself in your proving mode, gently remind yourself to back off. Or, as I suggested, you might investigate what that mind state is like and where it takes you. You can say something simple to yourself like, whoops, there I go again. Be sure to laugh at and be easy with yourself. Don't make letting go of your ego into yet another contest. It's not an emergency. You've certainly had it for a long time. Be patient and it will happen. And then he goes on to talk about all the great things that are to be gained by not living in that obsession with the rightness of self. So here we are. We've got examples from me and examples from a published author about little bits of wisdom. We've heard these bits of wisdom before. And we go, okay, I've heard it. Maybe even I've had little bits of freedom from this stress, from this sense of self. But here I am, obsessed again, right? I've got the eye cream at home, you know, and it's just a reality that that still we have this sense of self. Each day, still we have this sense of self. So then it's probably all about, well, I've got it, so what am I going to do with it, right? Because it's not just going to just, well, forgive me, I don't mean to impugn any of your ability to have an immediate enlightenment experience. I doubt it'll happen while I'm talking, but I certainly hope it for all of you. But likely, most of us are going to still have this self thing going on tomorrow. I've got another good friend who's a recovering alcoholic. I have more than a few friends who are recovering alcoholics. When she got sober, she did it by embracing a concept of self that was quite wrapped up with, I am an alcoholic. Now, in some ways, that's no surprise, because she'd spent years proving to herself that she wasn't alcoholic. Every time she wrecked a car or lost a friend or something, she'd have to convince herself why she wasn't an alcoholic. So finally, she went to the opposite identification. And it was miraculous. It had a huge difference in her life. Better friend, more caring, etc. And also, there were some things that came with it for her, which was, this is the only way to recover from alcoholism. If you drink, I can't be with you, to others. And a certain tightness around this identity of being a recovering alcoholic. So, you know, all of our identities, we definitely can trade one for another, and that can be a really good thing. I think we all have little bits of identity that we're ready to trade in, to trade up to another kind of identity. And there can also be consequences, some good things and some bad things about these various identities that we have. So she had beliefs about herself that she made into an identity. And there were some good things, and there were some bad things. So I talked about going through the self today, through some of our beliefs about ourselves, to do the work that we're doing. So we're going to go back into pairs, go back into the same things. And we're going to do an exercise that's called a repeating question. Okay? A repeating question. So the person with the longest hair on their head is going to start, okay, by asking again and again for 3 minutes the following question. Tell me a belief you have about yourself. And the person then with the shorter hair is going to say, I am something something, whatever it is. I am smart, I am chubby, I am whatever. Now, the person doing the asking is there to be a supportive witness. There is no feedback. You are not allowed to argue with somebody's thoughts about themselves. You are not allowed to correct them. And, in fact, you're not even allowed to talk with them about it outside of this room without their permission. Okay? At the same time, given those protections, you don't have to share your most intimate things with a stranger that you met Wednesday morning at Spirit Rock. So this is about a flavor. This is about an exercise and a process. It's not about doing your life's work today in 3 minutes. Okay? So there is an asker, there is a witness, and after a period of time, I will ring the bell, and you will switch roles. So the asker, again, tell me a belief you have about yourself. Person answers. The asker says thank you and simply asks the question again. Okay? Pair up. Go. I hope that went well. So I'd like each of you to kind of go inside for a moment. And I'd like you to consider the answers that you gave, the beliefs that you have about yourself. Pick one of them, any one of them, and ask yourself, is this belief true? Is there any way to verify this belief objectively? Does this belief serve my highest aspirations? Do I perhaps want to take this belief and trade up to another in its place? Again, echoing what we've talked about before, how have you felt about having these beliefs? What was the experience like of saying things that you believe to be true about yourself? What's the flavor of your experience right now? The feeling tone? Does this feeling tone, this way of being, serve your highest aspirations? Might you want to trade in this feeling tone or this way of being, trade up to some other one? So thank you. For the next week or so, or as long as it's useful to you, every time the belief that you pick manifests itself, whether subtly or right out front as you're saying it to someone else, or doing an action that depends on that belief being true in order to motivate you to do that action, I'd like you to check in with your body. Check in with your feeling tone about what your experience is, what your actual experience is out of that belief. Ask yourself if that feeling tone or that belief serves you. Really, just don't do all of those beliefs. Just pick one, because if you pick them all, it really would be an unmanageable project, and that would be too much. So just pick that one. I'm really asking you just to be mindful of a belief you have, to notice how it affects your body, what the sensations are, what the thoughts are that arise with it, and what actions you take that go along with that belief. If you find that this belief is not useful, I invite you to trade it in for another. My friend who went into recovery, as I have done, traded one set of beliefs for another. She decided to believe something different about herself, and it made a huge and incredible difference in her life. the experience of trading one belief for another is really astoundingly liberating. And it's astoundingly liberating because in either a grand way or even a very small way, you discover that you can live differently based on some belief that you're operating out of. Once you discover that you can live differently based on a belief that you're operating out of, you can have the experience of the beliefs being empty and meaningless, which means you can pick whichever ones work, whichever ones meet your highest aspirations for yourself. I've countless times traded in beliefs. The story I tell myself is that I'm getting wiser as I get older, so I come to believe new things. Some of them don't help so much. Some of them make an incredible difference in my life. I really invite you to do the same. It's the giving up of beliefs that is really the opportunity here. The discovering that we can shed them and let them go. Because where we make space, new things can enter. So I encourage you to play with letting go of beliefs. Feel free, by the way, to really embody a belief, really go with it. Having a sense of self is nothing to be ashamed about. You know, when you're enlightened and you no longer have a sense of self, you won't be ashamed about the sense of self you had, so there's no reason to do it now. But most importantly, see if you can investigate the experience of letting go of these beliefs, letting go of these thoughts that you have about yourself. In what is perhaps my very favorite poem, Rumi talks about the human experience. And I invite you to listen to this poem as if it was Rumi writing about beliefs. This being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. So that is what's possible when we practice and are able to just let go of beliefs we have about ourselves. That is going through the self that stands in the way of our happiness. And I hope that that is a fruitful exercise for you. And that is all I have to say as a prepared remark. So is there any discussion or questions, please? Yes.
I sat here and I did feel like judgment, and it changed. And I really wanted to let you know that I really like the way that you presented yourself. I feel like I know much more about you now because I felt like it came from the heart and a place that is very authentic about you. It spoke about yourself, not about the philosophy that I like. And I could get in touch with myself during this time, and I'm just feeling good. I'm feeling like I know much more about you. You're real, and this is nice material for me.
I'm so glad.
I want also to say this side, it's not only the judgment.
Thank you very much. Yeah. And at the same time, woohoo! So, yes, it's great to get support in the propping up of ourselves, you know? It takes so much energy to do it on our own. Thank you very much. And I say that out of a commitment that I've heard a couple of friends say, that if we can use everything as practice, so even that interaction, you know, is a way, to, an opportunity to know. It doesn't take away at all from the joy I feel in providing you with a good experience. Yeah. Yeah.
Is the eye makeup helping you?
I don't know. kind of silly, isn't it?
No.
Thank you so much. Comments or questions or offerings?
Well, when you asked us to contemplate one of the judge, or one of the beliefs we had about ourselves, and then you asked, is it really true? Well, I went to, yes, it really is.
Uh-huh.
So, but then the rest of them, like, does it serve me in any way? The answer is no. So, just any thoughts you have about moving yourself off a stuck place of really grasping and clinging to a belief?
Well, you know, my teacher, one of my teachers, Eugene Cash, he always says, let it rip! So really, the way through is, what did I say? If it's in the way, it is the way. So I would say, go to that belief you have and really feel it, really believe it, really go, and it, I promise you, it will take you somewhere. It will take you somewhere. And my guess is that it will take you to, if it's a painful one, that it will take you to an earlier time when the foundation of that belief got built, and that you will then have the opportunity to dig the foundation out from under the belief so that it can naturally fall away of its own accord. And that's why I say, if it's a lot, you don't have to do it all at once, and you certainly don't have to do it alone. You can talk with other people about it. Yes.
I was just going to say that I was incredibly gratified with the repeating question. I mean, I think that I was at a meditation retreat where I think we did repeating questions, and we did it for about 15 minutes.
Yes.
So it can go very deep that way. Mm-hmm. But what I was gratified for myself was that the things that starting out for the time I had that I said about myself were positive things, affirming things, and I am doing a lot of work in that area, and it was just very nice to not have all of the self-recriminations and the self-doubts and what's wrong with me be the things that were coming up for me. So thank you for that experience.
That's delightful. Good. Thanks. Anything else?
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed
that. I'm delighted. Thank you.
Opened new awareness to me in terms of getting in touch with that judgmental part of myself and being a human.
Yeah. And there is freedom. There is freedom available. Yeah. That's the thrilling, really thrilling part of it. Yeah. So let's sit for a couple minutes. Turning our attention towards seeing the truth is a great, great good, an undertaking which can sometimes be painful, but produces ripples of helpful and productive things around us in our own lives and in the lives of the people we touch. In the Buddhist tradition, it also is thought to produce really great, wonderful karma, which will live with us in this life and on into other lives. And the good news about this is that we can take these great effects, these benefits, and dedicate them to the health and welfare and the awakening of others. So let us intend that the goodwill and the positive energy that we have created today, and that even the difficulty of discovery will lead to good things, and that all of that be dedicated to the awakening of all beings in all forms and times and dimensions and incarnations in all directions on this earth and beyond, that all beings might live in happiness and contentment and find the end of suffering.